Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me this week was John Heinsohn of US-based content and consultancy Bunnygraph. He's the CEO and executive producer. John was joining me from the US. He'll be in Australia next month. And we spoke to him about his transition from traditional television to the digital world and his views on storytelling in a cross-media platform. I'm Tim Burrows. Thank you very much for joining me. Today's guest is John Heinsohn, who runs a company called Bunnygraph Entertainment. John, you have something of a TV heritage. And I guess more than many people, you've made that transition from the world of traditional television to this newly developing space. Maybe talk us through your journey to begin with.
Sure. So this next year is my 20th year in Los Angeles. And you're right, I had a very traditional path where I was a news producer when I was an undergrad at the University of Arizona, and then came out to Los Angeles to go to film school at the American Film Institute. And after finishing my second year, it was an environment where there was no digital video yet. So most of the people doing short projects were shooting on 35 millimeters. So it was a very, very expensive environment to be a short form storyteller. And so what happened was I was very interested in television as opposed to film. And so I had just done a pilot presentation for Castle Rock, which was the company that had produced Seinfeld. And I went to go work at, I knew I either had to commit to TV or commit to film. And so I took a job at ICM, which is one of the four big talent agencies. And so that's a very traditional entry-level job, which then eventually got me to the Fox Network. I eventually worked myself up to being a program executive at a time when there was a lot of upheaval at the networks. So, for instance, in my 4 years at Fox, we had three presidents. So that was very common at the time. And so, but what was interesting was, and this is in 1999, there was this shift with the web. And it was at a time where you could tell that the web was eventually going to become a programming platform. That's what all the tech, that's what all the futurists were saying at the time. And so I found that very interesting. And at a broadcast network where they're always fighting for promotional time for the new TV shows, I knew that the web provided a way to engage audiences in between broadcast episodes. And so in 1999, if you had asked me what job I wanted, it would have been to have been the executive that would have been the bridge between on-air and the web. And it's essentially a position at today that doesn't really exist at the networks still. With the advent of reality television, a lot of the program executives like myself kind of cycled out. There were not a need for them anymore. And so then I kind of focused on my family and other things like that. And I was actually a stay-at-home dad for 2 years, which was a great experience. And then in 2005, I got interested in the mobile space. One of the problems that the web has always had, web series and things like that, even today, is that all the freedom that the web provides takes away the focus of eyeballs, which is the foundation of monetization in television. That's why nobody's making money on the web. So I knew that that was the case, right? So, but I saw the potential of the mobile space as one, given the structure between the carriers and whatnot, as one that could have some real monetization. And so that's kind of what I focused in on. And I really just tried to become an expert in this space that was very immature at the time. One of the problems was that if you had built an interactive piece for your phone in 2005, the first demo I ever did, you would have had to build an app for every handset. That was the problem. See, there was no standardization across the carriers and across devices. We've now gotten past that ever since the advent of the iPhone and now with Android and all the rest. So the mobile space now is really kind of maturing. Now what happened was in 2008, made for mobile essentially died off because of the economy and whatnot. But now what's happened is because of the advent of tablets and second screen experiences, the mobile space has kind of come around full circle. And so in conjunction with my experience in traditional television, it really has kind of made me very well suited for this transmedia space that people talk so much about today. And well, that's where I'm at.
That's a great introduction to yourself. And it's worth making the point that one of the reasons
So we're having this conversation as you'll be in Sydney fairly soon, speaking both at Amplify and at Mumbrella 360. Now, if anyone does want to ask John a question, the hashtag we're suggesting is Ask John Heinsohn. So that's Ask John Heinsohn, H-E-I-N-S-E-N. And my colleague Kathy is moderating the social media stream on this. And this is probably a good opportunity for me to bring in Kathy. Kathy, is there a question that you want to ask?
I guess the question I'd like to, I think this has been raised in a comment, is, isn't transmedia a bit of a buzzword that's got no real meaning in a kind of commercial context?
Sure. So one of the things that's really interesting is that I'm actually the vice chairman of the New Media Council of the Producers Guild of America. And it's really been a wonderful opportunity and platform for me to evangelize and to help educate about the mobile space and now the transmedia space. So in 2010, one of my colleagues, Jeff Gomez, worked with the Producers Guild to actually coin the actual approved film credit, transmedia producer. And they came with a definition of credit. Well, now this is something that caused a lot of controversy across the industry still to this day. And so now that kind of the term transmedia has hit the mainstream, a lot of people, especially like in the advertising space, consider it just this buzzword, exactly what you were saying. Now, what I love to say about it is that what transmedia represents is a freedom for storytellers to engage audiences on whatever platform they live. And because this new form of engagement is rooted in freedom, then people should be free to call it whatever the hell they want. That's what I think. So for me personally, I don't necessarily use transmedia. The term I use is storytelling through advanced content. That's what this my sensibility kind of directs me in terms of this new content. But I won't bite someone's head off for saying transmedia, although I know a lot of people that will.
Now, a related question to that, I think, is just because the technology changes and makes it easier to potentially find an audience, does that mean that you can actually cut production costs, for instance?
Absolutely. Well, one of the big things is it's not necessarily about cutting costs, but it's about how and where the money is spent. So, for instance, a lot of this ancillary digital content has traditionally come out of marketing at the networks and studios. And see, from the producer's perspective, when marketing comes in and tries to do something creative, it's always seen as intrusive, right? So now, because with this new transmedia model, all the creative is really put back in the hands of the producers. And so now, because that money is spent in principal photography, you have that continuity to the mainstream product and that production value, right? You make it the cost of doing business. So, yes, it is always cheaper to fold something into your main production than to bring in some whole new crew to try to throw something together. And what I would say about the technology piece is this. I think this new space that we're talking about here is a convergence of three things that have always been very siloed within our industry. It's traditional media, branded advertising, and technology. And it's technology that's the last mile, and that's always an evolution. And if you want to be a cutting-edge storyteller, you have to be married to cutting-edge technology. And you have to be flexible to the technologies that are available to you. If I'm going to create some interactive content, and I'm going to take it and shop it to all the networks, what one network is doing in the mobile space might be different than another. So I have to be flexible to that, to the capabilities of the buyer.
And is this debate on the best way of, I guess, structuring the budget, is this now a settled debate?
It's definitely going back and forth. I mean, the reason why I'm involved with the Producers Guild and not the Writers Guild is because I really do feel it's the producers that are going to drive this new type of content. Mainstream producers are going to collaborate with younger and seasoned producers in the new media space, people like myself who understand not only this new medium and these new platforms that the audience is engaging, but also where we're evolving from. That's the other big thing. The studios are this big machine, and there's still a lot of money in the traditional areas, and that's why it's been very hard for digital to get a foothold, because if you're still making money in these other areas, people are afraid to change.
Another question is, what did you think of Prometheus, which is why I guess been much lauded as a great example of some ancillary transmedia content? Did you think that was a good example? Do you think it worked?
Sure. Yeah, I think it did work. I mean, that's the great thing about this time that we're in, you know. In a lot of ways, the traditional studios networks are, you know, they're in these places where they know the world is changing and they know they're not necessarily going to have a place in it, right? And in a lot of ways, we're children in a dark room. And there's only a handful of us that are ready to reach for the light switch. And the minute that things become standardized, there'll be money for everybody. But right now, it's a very immature space. And I often hypothesize that the evolution of this digital space is very similar to early television, both from a technological standpoint, from a business model standpoint, and from a creative standpoint. So whereas a lot of people are very afraid of the future and just about the audience in general, I think a lot of people in my position, you know, are they know this is the time to take chances. And that's what Prometheus is doing, you know. So I think it's great.
You got to test the waters. Going back to a previous portion of your career, you led a chunk of programming at the Fox Network for about 5 years, from about 1997. I suppose a local connection to us here in Australia is Rupert Murdoch. What do you make of his instincts for television and moving into this new space as well?
Well, see, what I've found to be extremely difficult as someone that really is trying to embrace and trying to lead this new space, it is about a lot of the mainstream executives that are just very much still in that old antiquated way of doing things. You know, you can read about Rupert Murdoch and Peter Chernin and a lot of these people. They're very forward-thinking, aware people. But it's all the people that are under them that aren't necessarily embracing these new things. You know, I remember in 1999 that, you know, the Fox Network would not put that 70sShow.com at the end of the episode on air because people thought that people would turn off the TV and go to the computer. They did not realize they were engaging both things at the same time, you know? So that was really tough. I remember Fox had just made a deal with Yahoo in 1999 when we had a Jennifer Love Hewitt series called Time of Your Life, which was a spinoff of Party of Five. And so here's this high-profile episode, this high-profile series with this beautiful star. Everybody's embracing it. All the traditional entertainment marketing is pushing this new series. I remember Fox had just made a deal with Yahoo, big money deal, big money in the trades. And on the day that the television series launched, if you went to Yahoo Entertainment's homepage, Jennifer Love Hewitt wasn't on it. So there was a big disconnect at the time. You know, the other thing too that's really tough, and it's still the case with television today, is that it's a world built in fear. Why do they kill television shows after two episodes? Because they're worried their ratings are going to get worse. And if the ratings get worse, the financial implications are worse. And that's why two episodes, in and out. It happens at every network every year. It's the same thing with the advertising space. I've made a lot of money in the last, you know, handful of years working for advertising agencies who the creative work that I did never even made it to the client, because at these agencies, the digital are always the bastard stepchildren. That print and on air are still the ones that drive the relationship. And so if you've got something innovative on the digital space that you're going to take to the client, it's putting the company at big risk, because if what you're doing is a success, that means digital get more budget and print and on air won't. If it's a failure, then it could put the account at risk. And a lot of big agencies have gone belly up because they lose the Gatorade account. So the advertising world is based in fear. Now technology is something that is not based in fear. That's why guys like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and, you know, can do so well.
Do you think it's partly a mistaken belief that digital is kind of cheaper, lower to produce, and lower costs to produce, and therefore it's a bit more throwaway, and then production values can be lower? Do you think that's where the sort of mistake comes from?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, if you, like I said, you go back to 1994 when I was, you know, a 25-year-old. I mean, I was making short films that were $400,000 because there was no digital video yet. Now you've got kids that are shooting features with their telephones, with their cell phones, right? So it obviously is much more cheaper. The big thing is in the digital space, whether it's the mobile web or in the web itself, if you're talking about storytelling, is there's no standardization, right? So the unit of measure really is the cost per minute. Because if I've got a funny show about two guys in a bar, is that show 30 seconds or 7 minutes, right? That's all going to dictate things. Well, because there's no standardization yet, this is why it's the wild, wild west. See what I mean? So what I try to do is that I try to create formats. And when I was focused specifically on mobile, creating these formats where I could get 30 to 100 episodes. Because very often what would happen is somebody would come up with a funny idea and somebody would give them money to produce 10 episodes. And the problem is that if those 10 episodes build any audience, they're going to want 10 more. And so you've got to develop something that both has the strength of character to build out to more episodes, as well as a financial model. So for instance, if you remember Amped Mobile, which I don't know if it was in Australia or not, but it was a huge mobile initiative, rich media initiative here in the States. And it went down as one of the worst venture deals in history. This has been highly publicized. It was $360 million in venture funding, and they went broke in like 17 months. And on the day they shut off the phone, they hardly had any money yet. And I was in the process of negotiating a content deal at the time, and their cost per minute for original content was only $500 a minute. Okay, the average for mobile in 2008 was $150 a minute. Now, the problem is if you take a sitcom like That 70s Show at $1.5 million for 30 minutes, that's $67,000 a minute. There is a big financial disconnect between the digital space and mainstream television and film.
Well, so we're not there yet. We probably have five or six minutes left before we finish up. So if you do want to ask John a question, the hashtag is Ask John Heinsohn. John, what are the implications for brand-funded entertainment around this, do you think?
Absolutely. I think it's a very exciting time. So, you know, it's just like in the advent of early television where you had single sponsors. Now, a lot of these traditional areas are getting very clouded because of the whole notion of brand engagement and brand reach. As I had said before, it's traditional media, branded advertising, and technology, and it's social media that really fuels it all, right? It's not about building a website and they will come. It's about going where people live and giving them something that they not only will be excited to engage, but they'll be excited to share. And so, for instance, the advertising agencies are the ones that are really up on the ropes because, for instance, they usually would manage the relationships with these brands. And now, in many cases, if you see a brand doing something interesting in the digital space, odds are it's coming from the brand directly. You look at some of these brands like Pepsi and things like that, Jeep, great brands that are doing a lot of interesting content things. They really see it as this subculture of brand. And if you take two very similar brands, I'm trying to think of something that's in Australia, but even like Ford and Chevy, you know, they consider themselves very different, although the consumer might not. So it's the whole idea about digging deeper, right? So going back to that idea about two guys in a bar, you know, if you're going to have a show of two guys in the bar and they're there every Friday night, you know, the traditional model would be you would create the show, the brands would look at it, and who are they going to invest, right? Is it going to be Budweiser or Foster's, okay? Well, now what happens is I'm going to go to the brand directly, and I'm going to develop the sensibility and the characters of the show representative of the brand. So it's not just product placement anymore. It's creating a show that really speaks to what Foster's would consider their brand so that the branding becomes seamless. And that's going to be what's least intrusive to the audience. And then what the exciting thing is in terms of a business model is that if you have Foster's investing in some mobile content, two guys in a bar, and it really does build a great audience, you know, could that become a television show that Foster's would own? And they would financially benefit from being an owner of that television show. It's about the storytelling, right? Now, is that web series that Foster's going to create, is that going to live on YouTube? Is that going to live on Foster's website? Is that going to live on a network's channel? Is it going to live in some other place? Nobody knows yet because there's no standardization.
Kathy, I think we're almost out of time, so let me just go to you for one final question, if I can, please.
Last question from the comments is could you explain a bit more about what this One Night on Earth project is and what brings you to Australia?
Sure. So for many, many years, I've been very interested in getting involved with a global social good project, and I'd been looking at a relationship with the UN Foundation and things like that. And so, but my schedule is very tough because I lead all the digital for the Academy Awards for ABC. So 6 months out of the year, I'm extremely busy, and 6 months out of the year, I'm not as busy. And so I had been an advisor to a mobile company that had been talking to this group out of Australia about a charity concert that they wanted to do. And so I participated in a couple of phone calls and got very interested in the project. And so I've now become the director of digital media for this project, which is called One Great Night on Earth. It was born out of a group out of Melbourne, Australia. The heart and soul of this thing is a gentleman by the name of Chip Monk. And in rock history, Chip Monk is very, very famous. He is actually the person that was the voice of Woodstock, and he's the godfather of stage lighting. So if you see that when you go to a concert and you see all the crazy stage lights, he invented most of that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And at a certain point, he was the Rolling Stones tour manager and all the rest. So I love collaborating with people that have had these great, wonderful experiences. And so I've really had a wonderful time developing this project. We're hoping to get it launched in its inaugural year next spring. It's designed to redefine social good through music by, instead of just creating a concert as a reaction to a natural disaster, this would actually be a brand that would have a decade of concerts, 10 years of concerts, that would create a fund to be distributed. And so the first 2 years of the concert will be here in Australia, and our goal is to benefit a charity called Fine Green Paddock, which is one that is for flood and fire victims. And so it's something that I know a lot of people outside of Australia are not aware of. And so I'm very excited about the challenge as director of digital media to help create this awareness, this community, and to really take it to a new place. Because what's exciting about the digital space is, and you're a content creator, is three things. It's content, conversation, and community. And everything you develop has to be centered around that, whether it's a brand experience, a social good experience, or a storytelling experience. And so that's my challenge with One Great Night on Earth. I'm very proud to be a part of the project.
Well, I think we only just begin to scratch the surface. So we're looking forward to seeing you in Sydney next month, John. Now, I think it's must be at 10:45 where you are in California. So thank you very much for putting off going to bed for us. And we look forward to seeing you next month. And thank you also to Kathy.
That's it from the Mumbrella Cast for this time. More soon.